This podcast is brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Lectures, radio shows, and more on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Author Paul Klein developed his talent for creating images out of words in a career as a radio performer and a filmmaker. Now he has entered the literary world with a new novel, Accidents of Time and Place. Hector Collin, the hero of the novel, is a veteran of the Korean War and a victim of the anti-communist hysteria of the 1950s. Accidents of Time and Place tells the story of his journey from infamy to redemption. Join Paul Klein as he reads from his novel at the New Dominion Bookshop on April 10, 2008.
The background of the story is a time of war and the threat of war and war again. A war many felt was unnecessary and certainly unpopular. It's also a time when politicians tried to use current events to enhance their own standing and secure their personal futures. If that sounds contemporary, it isn't. The story takes place more than 50 years ago. And is it a true story? Are the characters and events real? Well, when I started college in the early 1950s, many of the men and women who I went to school with had served many years in the military. They had fought for the future they were about to live, and my characters are based on those people. Let me introduce you to some of the characters so that you have some idea of where we're going with this. Hector Collin is the central character. He's in his 30s when we meet him, a tall, dark-haired young man, born in the coal country of Pennsylvania. In his teens and 20s, he served in the Army, first in Japan as part of the Army of Occupation, and then in Korea at the beginning of that war. Hector has always been a quiet, unassuming young man, not much given to planning beyond the day, but sometimes making choices and decisions that put him in great danger or difficulty. Jane, whom Hector marries at a time when his life is going extremely well, is a kind, generous young woman, responding to people in a positive and a happy way. She is someone who has found the things that bring her satisfaction, and Hector is one of them. Dean is one of Hector's friends at the university. He's a little older than Hector. He was a school teacher before the war, and like Hector, has taken advantage of the GI Bill. As the story develops, he achieves his goal of working on Capitol Hill in the office of a congressman. In the course of his work, he will bring Hector a measure of trouble and anxiety and another opportunity for heroism. Sis is Hector's sister. All during his military service, Hector remained away from home, but he regularly sent part of his pay to his family. That money allowed Sis to go to college and become a teacher. Finding that less fulfilling than she thought, she has applied for a job as an intelligence analyst and now, after years of separation from her brother, has come to Washington to work. She and Dean find each other and establish a relationship. These are the main characters. There are a few others, of course, but it's through these people that you will learn about accidents of time and place. I think you all know that I'm a film writer by trade, primarily. And I'm very conscious of the images that I create. It goes back, however, to my radio days that started when I was in high school. I always loved radio because it forced me to supply the pictures. Film was only a little less challenging because of that. One must create verbal descriptions of the images that would be committed to film by someone else. So for me in this book, I have supplied the images from my internal visual library. There is a grammar in film, and pictures can be used to provide the syntax and form. That's the best part, that and dialogue. We all talk all the time, but when you have a limited time frame or opportunity, you'd best make sure your words and pictures tell the story in the most economical way. The secret of being a bore, Voltaire said, is to tell everything. What I have selected to read to you are long enough to be intriguing, short enough to leave a lot for you to discover on your own. So, from the book, I've divided my selections into things that illustrate place and time and accidents in that sequence, sort of backwards from the title. And so we begin with chapter 1, New Ronda. When the wind blows in New Ronda, it carries the grit and acidic breath of the mines. There is a darkness in the air and on the ground that isn't noticed until it is there, ingrained in the surface. It is seen by those who go there, but not by those who are born to it. The chill of fall and the heart of winter can mix to form a gray, etching mist that settles on lives as well as on things. The red and cream Trailways bus pulled into the parking space and eased to a stop at the back of the bus station, on the hill overlooking the town. It was dark, a frosty October night in the mine-pierced mountains, and the steaming windows of the all-night restaurant beckoned, but not to Hector Collin. Taking his small suitcase from the luggage compartment under the bus, he stepped out into the sparkling darkness. The long street that began on Terminal Hill crossed the railroad tracks that bisected the town and climbed the other side. New Ronda sat in a bowl, the mines tunneled under the streets, and the tipples and elevator houses stood silhouetted against the sky in every direction. Three blocks above the center of town, the young man turned north onto a narrow, poorly paved street of small frame houses. Old trees kept the yards in shade, even on a bright full moon night like this. Dogs barked once or twice, sensing a stranger passing by, but none challenged him. At his parents' house, he turned, walked up the slate path from the street, and knocked on the door. It's the first time he's been home in many, many years. From Chapter 2, Washington, D.C. Look out over the 69 square miles that make up Washington, D.C. A few low hills surround a bowl that empties into the Potomac River. It can be a damp and cold place in the winter, a damp and hot place in the summer. By 1955, more than a century and a half after it was first laid out, it was still at heart a small southern town. There were museums and art galleries and even a theater or two, and the words that floated in the air came from every corner of the earth, but it was still small and still just a town. The commercial buildings along K Street in Northwest Washington were mostly converted townhouses, many with a few apartments or professional offices in the upper stories. The Vienna had been built as a restaurant, and so was entered at street level rather than up a half flight of stairs as most of the old houses were built. That set it apart and gave it a more legitimate, business-like appearance. It was narrow and deep, having replaced a townhouse by occupying the same footprint, even though the bricks and plaster were new. Booths lined both sides of the long room, with square tables for four in the middle. At the back was the dividing wall separating the kitchen from the dining room. A glass-fronted counter extended from the entrance parallel to the side wall, making a small enclosed space for the cash register. Behind the glass in neat rows were five brands of chewing gum, an open box with rolls of mints, opened boxes of candy bars, and finally, neatly arrayed packets of aspirin and antacid. A divider split the display case, and on the other side were cigars and cigarettes, formally set out in their boxes and half cartons. On top of the counter was a small vase with a fresh flower, taller than the display rack holding book matches with the restaurant's name on the cover and a chrome-plated toothpick dispenser that stood beside it. A lot of what takes place in the book takes place in the Vienna. You may remember the Vienna. I don't know.
No, but it reminds me of something.
There you go. Chapter 4, In the Lobby. This is where Hector Collin lives. The King of Romania had not been a transient hotel for many years, but the dark oak registration desk and the framed opening that rose above it still looked as it had when travelers were the hotel's main business. The plastered walls around the desk and windows were once a creamy white, but now only seemed bright in contrast to the dark wood. Standing behind the desk, one could see the double glass doors to the left that led to the street. Across from that was the broad staircase with its worn carpeting and dark wood banister. The wood had felt the caress of so many hands that it no longer showed its grain, but was simply dark, almost black. In Washington's humid weather, the wood became sticky if a hand rested on it too long. To the right of the desk was another set of double doors leading to the first floor rooms. Behind the desk, a door next to the wall of pigeonholes led to a small office, the manager's private domain, a place she seldom entered during the day. A small area to the right of the front doors and to the left of the staircase held four overstuffed sofas set in a square around a low table. Two armchairs on either side of a small round table were placed at the hotel's street-facing front window. Against the wall that formed the third side of the small lobby was an ornate mantel surrounding a bricked-over fireplace, a relic of the hotel's early days. What light there was came from the window, the glass doors, and a black iron chandelier suspended from the ceiling in the middle of the lobby area. Except on sunny days, the lobby was less than inviting as a place to sit, especially if one wanted to read the daily paper put on the low table each morning. But the King of Romania was clean, the beds reasonably comfortable, and the atmosphere anonymous, or at least it seemed that way. Those are three of the key locations in this story that you'll find. And now some selections that talk about time. Chapter 8, In Time of War. When you are 16 or 17 and your country is at war, Hector was saying, it all seems so glamorous, so exciting, and at the same time, scary. Another long pause then. I finished school in the middle of the year and needed to go to work. The war was on, and it was that or the mine, so I chose the war. That's how it was, at least for me. I knew I'd be drafted soon anyway, so I just went and signed up. He rested again. The metal wheels of the car sang, the warning gong clanged, and the capsule rocked on across the city. Even if the war had been over, I probably would have done the same thing. I didn't want to go into the mine. Again, silence. Jane reflected on her own escape from home, though it was just across the river in a small village beyond Arlington. Hardly more than a crossroads, and nodded her head in understanding. I couldn't wait to get away from home either, she said. Not that there was anything wrong, I just wanted to be on my own. I'm glad I did it. Hector looked directly at her reflection. Oh, I'm not sorry I left, he said, the inflection in his voice rising. Whatever happened, I knew it had to be better than the mines. A short silence. And then he began a story that would continue after the two left the streetcar to walk to Jane's apartment. The story he told was not unusual for his age and time. In the Army, he had completed basic training, then had been selected for clerk school. He learned to type, to file, to fill in forms, and make reports for his sergeant or the lieutenant to sign. He was very good at the work, and so he remained at the training center, attached to the headquarters staff. When the war was over, without enough points for discharge, he was sent to a replacement depot. From there, he was assigned to an infantry unit for occupation duty in Japan. I like being in a foreign country, being far enough away from home to not even think about going back to it. It was a devastated country, but he had been assigned to an infantry unit stationed at Zama near Tokyo. His camp had been an officer cadet training center with permanent buildings for both offices and barracks. As the local rail transportation system was reestablished, Hector, like so many others, took passes to visit cities and villages around the main island. After a while, it wasn't so foreign. Some of the countryside even looked a little like Pennsylvania near where I came from. All in all, Hector said, it had been a good time. Chapter 18, Fame and Misfortune. Is that where I want to be? It was June, about the middle of the month, when the letter arrived. Hector was going through the day's mail when he came to it. It was a subpoena calling Hector to a hearing by a congressional subcommittee that was charged with investigating the spread of communism. As he read the letter, he pushed the chair away from the table. His erect posture seemed to melt slowly into a slump. He thought he knew what the committee and its investigators were looking for. Everyone in Washington understood that. They were trying to root out threats posed by something called the International Communist Conspiracy. But how Hector fit into that scheme, he did not understand. In all the discussions and newspaper articles he had seen and heard, nothing demanded his attention or allegiance, nothing except a report that he had heard on a radio newscast that the Warriors at Peace leadership was being investigated. His lack of curiosity was not a conscious act, Hector knew. He simply didn't have the kind of mind that pursued details unless they were related to something that directly concerned him. So when the subpoena arrived, Hector was surprised, but only mildly curious. "Did you get a lot done today?" Jane asked. Most evenings, when Jane wasn't working, they would sit near the window overlooking the avenue and talk about the day. Sometimes, but not always, they would have a glass of wine or share a beer while they sipped as they talked. As a matter of fact, Hector said, "I was writing pretty well most of the morning until the mail arrived." Reaching for the envelope that was on the bleached oak coffee table in front of the sofa, Hector handed it to Jane. Jane looked at the paper without reading it. Handing it back, she asked, "What's this?" "It says I have to come before the Robinson Commission on the House of Representatives." "The what?" Jane's question was marked by only a little more curiosity than Hector's. "The Robinson Commission," he replied. "That House committee that Dean is working for?" "I hear people talking about it sometimes at the Vienna," Jane said, nodding. "Sounds scary. What do they want to talk to you about?" "I don't know. I haven't paid that much attention to what they are all about." It was a position Hector would soon discover that wasn't very wise or comfortable. And finally, what the book is about, accidents, events that take place. And again from Chapter 8 and Time of War. It wasn't particularly cold, especially in the headquarters tent. They were back of what was a very narrow front line, below the crest of the hill. It had just grown dark, but the sergeant, the tent's only occupant at this hour, was typing a report. The officers were in their hooch not far away, and Hector, occasionally sipping coffee from his canteen cup, was taking his time. Outside, there were intermittent pops of rifle fire, and from time to time, the wall of the tent would glow from the light of an aerial flare. At irregular intervals, a howitzer somewhere behind the company area would send a shell whistling overhead toward an unseen target. He hardly noticed the short thumps and only vaguely recorded the slight lifting of the ground beneath him as the high explosive charges responded to the gunner's lanyard. "What the hell? Look out! Gooks! Jesus!" Shouts and shots suddenly erupted just beyond the tent. Drums, whistles, bugles blown off key shot through the October air. A machine gun began to rattle, a grenade made a clump sound, a voice screamed in pain. His attention suddenly redirected. Hector looked up, then jumped up as the tent flap was whipped aside. The face on top of the uniform was not his CO's, was not anyone he knew, was certainly not an American. "No, not me," he heard himself shout, falling involuntarily over the upset canvas stool. The enemy advanced into the tent, momentarily blinded by the bright gas lantern on a wire above Hector's olive-green desk. In that split second of fear and falling, Hector's hand fell on his M1 where it lay on the floor. In one motion, he grabbed it up, found the safety, and pulled the trigger. The semi-automatic weapon fired three, maybe four times, the recoil raising the rifle higher with each shot. His startled attacker fell back, dropped his own weapon, and died. With the adrenaline coursing through him, Hector scrambled to his feet, feeling the power that was so new to him, responding to forces he didn't know existed, knocked over the bullet-scarred desk, leaped over the prostrate enemy, and still shouting, "No, not me." Chapter 19, Hector and Dean. The room was painted a dull cream color, with dark oak window frames and an oak wainscoting that reached from the floor as high as the sills of the tall windows. The floor was uncarpeted except for a rectangle occupied by the long table with chairs for the committee on one side and a single chair for Hector on the other. Dean sat at one end of the table. Opposite Hector, in the center of the four men he faced, sat a young man with a thin face and a square jaw. Deeply tanned, his wavy dark brown hair was parted to one side. As he lowered his head, a thick lock would fall across his face. With his hand, he would push it back into place as he looked up, combing it with his fingers. His voice was harsh, nasal, distinctly New England. "You were in Korea, Mr. Collin," the nasal voice began again. "Anything happened to you there?" The words were harsh on Hector's ear. The man held up what looked to be a copy of a military report, which he then passed to the man next to him. "Is that my military record?" "Answer the question, please," the sharp-faced man responded. "If that's my record, then you know what it says," Hector replied. "I'm asking you," the lawyer said again. The trace of impatience in his voice was growing. Hector was trying to remain calm, but every word from the chairman's mouth pushed him backward toward that time so long ago. He placed his hands on the carved ends of the arms of the chair. Sitting straight, he brought his chin down as if he were again on the parade ground. "Sir," Hector began, reverting back to the respectful tone and slow cadence an experienced sergeant reserved for speaking to a junior officer. "With all due respect, I cannot see why my military record is being reviewed in this hearing. First of all, you have it in front of you, and whatever it says, I'm sure it is correct. Second," at this point, the Boston lawyer jumped in abruptly. "Mr. Collin, I ask the question, and I expect an answer. I decide what questions get asked, and you, sir, are under obligation to answer them." The chairman, Hector realized, was responding just as a junior lieutenant would. It gave him some satisfaction to see that the game still worked. Every soldier who survives basic training, Hector thought to himself, learns how to play with career-conscious second lieutenants. After 10 years in the Army, any soldier worth his rank could keep untested officers off balance. It seemed to work with lawyers, too, he noted with satisfaction. "Sir," Hector began again, "I was sent to Korea as company sergeant. I served with a rifle company until I was wounded. I did what I was sent to Korea to do, and I did it to the best of my ability." And now from the last chapter, in which Hector sees his way to resolution and restoration. He and Jane are apart, and he has finally found the words to tell her how he feels about what has happened. From chapter 24, In the Depths in New Ronda. "I truly believe that with you beside me, I will find a way to be the writer I started out to be, find a way to make my voice heard. I will continue to say the things I believe need to be said in a way that might make a difference. Deep in my soul, I believe that the times we are going through, personally and politically, will eventually be reversed and good sense will prevail. I am just as certain that these times will likely come again, and that the voices like mine will still be heard once the clamor and confusion dies away. I want to be there when it does." And just a closing thought or two. Years ago, I was just starting to learn my craft, and I met a pretty young woman at a party in Georgetown. And we were getting acquainted, and she asked, "What do you do?" And I replied that I was a writer. And she said, "Oh, I'm a writer too. What do you write?" And I told her that at the moment I was writing a television series. And she said, "Television." And as if I had told her I wrote death warrants. And I said, "Well, what do you write?" And she said, "Well, the world isn't ready for my writing." And I said, "Well, the world isn't ready for mine either, but I write every day so that when the world is ready for me, I'll be ready for it. And I hope with this novel I am." Thank you. Sounds bigger than it is. That's wonderful.
You need a book on tape version, too.
Not yet.
I hope you will.
Well, I'm thinking about it. I've thought about it. There may be more of a market for that these days than for things between covers. People can hear it on their iPods. Thank you. You've got it. Okay, good. But you don't have the whole book, so they'll have to come here and buy the rest of the book. And that's good. Anyway, that's it for what I have to say, but I have lots of answers if you have questions. They may not apply, but I have answers.
And we've got to run because I have a conference call.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you so much, all of you, for coming. I really appreciate it. And we will gather again. And the next one will be out in a year or two.
When will the next one be?
Oh, gosh, I don't know, Ruth. I've got probably...
You have been listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit us at sevillepodcast.com.